Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve?
Hey, everybody. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back for another session. We're back in regular session now. We've taken 2 weeks off our Zoom calls, which will start next week. But this is our Harvey Sluggo Wasserman with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're back with some of our buddies from the Safe Energy Movement, the great Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. Paul, how you doing, bro?
Pretty good. No nukes.
No nukes. Tim with Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, buddy, how you doing?
Oh, good, Harvey. How are you?
Great to have you. And I think Kevin Camps is going to join us also. Kevin, are you with us yet? Okay, Kevin is going to be calling in. So as you know, folks, my listeners, we've been doing the grassroots emergency election protection calls in this slot because they are so important. We will be back next week with the number 46 to talk about election protection, which is, of course, under assault. I have heard, just read that the Republican Party plans to burn a cross in front of every polling station in a black area in the 2022 election. So we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, we have a ton of stuff to catch up on nuclear power and safe energy. And we have a major victory to report. Tim, maybe you want to talk about what has just happened in Ohio. We're joined by Kevin Camps. Kevin, are you there yet?
Yes, I am.
Kevin is. Oh, good. You're the great expert. So, Tim and then Kevin and then Paul, let's talk about what just happened with nuclear subsidies in Ohio. It is a major victory. The governor of Ohio has signed a repeal of a tax that was put on the ratepayers of Ohio to pay for Davis, Bessie, and Perry. Tim, you want to tell us about that, and then Kevin and Paul?
Sure. Well, Kevin can fill in a lot more details about Ohio since he's been on the ground. But, you know, this is the culmination of 7 years of battling with the First Energy Corporation in Ohio, which has been trying to get the state to subsidize its coal and nuclear plants, for all that time. And after, you know, a $60 million corruption scandal that's being prosecuted by the feds, the state finally repealed the nuclear bailout that was enacted in 2019. It's just been, you know, endless organizing and campaigning by grassroots groups on the ground in Ohio. It's just a major victory to have shut down that bailout.
It is incredible. Kevin Camps, you've been banging your head against the containment dome at Davis-Bessie for many, many, many years. What's the significance now of the repeal of this bailout?
Yeah, Tim did a good summary. I mean, it was more than $1 billion that would have gone to just two nuclear power plants in Ohio, Davis-Bessie, like you mentioned, and also Perry. Unfortunately, the downside of what just happened, and this was, you know, the legislature finally getting around a couple years later to repealing, like Tim said, this bill that was gotten a hold of through what's been called the largest bribery and racketeering scandal in Ohio history. Not by me
and
anti-nuclear
that's really
activists.
We're talking about Ohio here. To be the biggest bribery scandal in Ohio, that's something, you know. That's like pole vault
yeah.
30 feet.
It was the U.S. attorney at his press conference in July of 2020 that called it that. And they are proceeding with the investigation and potential prosecutions that have tentacles reaching all over the place. One of the recent developments was the chair of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio was implicated. Actually, Governor DeWine, who just, you know, signed the repeal, you know, thankfully, of the nuclear part of the bailout, he himself and his own daughter were implicated in receiving this dark money. So the tentacles are many. One of the downsides I want to mention is Tim had mentioned the coal bailout. That stays in place as of now. As does the aspect of HB6 that repealed energy efficiency and renewable energy requirements in Ohio. And that aspect of the bill, in addition to the nuclear bailout, has been referred to by various media coverage as the worst energy policy in the United States. So there's still a lot of work to do despite what is a tremendous victory. Talk about hard won. Yes, it's been the better part of a decade of just constant work to try to overturn this thing or to block it in the first place.
Yeah, it's unreal. Paul Gunter, you want to jump in on this one?
Well, I think it's important to celebrate our victories, recognizing that the nuclear industry is going to be persistent, particularly now with the Biden clean energy program on the slate. First energy and every other nuclear utility and its fledglings are going to be looking for bailout money from the federal taxpayer now. And that certainly is going to be the next battleground.
Yeah. So my understanding, Tim, we'll jump back to you, and we're going to get to your situation in New York with the Cuomo bailout. But my understanding is that people in Ohio are saying that First Energy whoever the current criminal is that's running these two nuclear plants. I think First Energy in their bankruptcy spun off another mob group to own and operate these two reactors, but that they have gone to the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and this says that if you're getting a bailout in the state, you can't raise your rates to a certain level, and that's why they went along with this. And that Perry and Davis Bessie are going to continue to operate and just raise their rates. Have you heard anything like that? And then we'll go to Kevin and Paul.
Well, I think there's a lot of questions to be answered about this. I mean, what seemed clear from the way that everything went down with this corruption scheme and, in the passage of the bailout legislation 2 years ago is that it was all connected to First Energy's subsidiary, First Energy Solutions, going through bankruptcy because basically it was this massively unprofitable company that owned coal and nuclear plants. And so in negotiating with their creditors, First Energy was proposing to spin off that whole part of the company to be a separate company that the creditors would then own. And it really seemed like the underlying deal was that First Energy had to get this bailout through so that company would essentially be subsidized under its creditors. And so now that the spinoff has happened, the creditors own the plant, and they're under indictment for corruption. First Energy seems to be happy to let the nuclear bailout go away. It's just not clear at all what's going to happen with the creditors. But miraculously, this new company, Energy Harbor, has not indicated that it's going to proceed with closing the plant just because it doesn't have subsidies now.
Thanks, Tim. Kevin, you're the one that's closest to Davis Bessie and Perry. Is this going to have any impact on their continued operations?
I sure hope so. Davis Bessie's 40-year license expired on Earth Day of 2017 and was supposed to retire that day. And incredibly, despite best efforts, we really tried to block that license extension. But it's, in the end, a rubber stamp by the NRC, even if it takes some years to accomplish. And, what you've got going on at Davis Bessie is more close calls with catastrophe than any other reactor in the United States, some narrowly averted. You've also got the cracked containment shield building that was revealed in 2011, late in 2011, and that became the focus of our intervention against the license extension. So what you've got is a reactor that's badly degraded, including embrittlement of the reactor pressure vessel, and you name the other pathways to meltdown, with a containment that will not contain. And in fact, the cracking is so bad that simple gravity could bring the shield building down. It's called spalling of concrete on the exterior face. And incredibly enough, there are safety-related system structures and components down below that could be taken out by large chunks of concrete just letting loose. So in that sense, the shield building, the containment, could cause the meltdown that it would then not contain at Davis Bessie. That's the absurdity of the risk levels of continuing to operate.
So what is the impact on the continued operation of Davis-Besse of the repeal of the subsidies?
I think it remains to be seen. You know, they desperately needed it at the Public Utilities Commission for several years. Then they turned to the state legislature through massive corruption and got what they wanted. And then all of a sudden they don't need it. So, you know, what's going on? These are unanswered questions.
Paul, I think this is Paul. Yeah, I think part of the problem has also been that, you know, the corporations haven't really been required to open their books. So this kind of anonymity to their financing has been a problem in trusting them one way or the other. Clearly, they're going to be coming after federal money now.
Unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. And Perry, of course, is the first reactor in the United States to have been damaged by an actual earthquake. I mean, I grew up in Columbus. I never heard the word earthquake relevant to Ohio until 1986, 3 days before the Challenger blew up. An earthquake could ever harm a nuclear plant in Ohio, but Perry was the one. It's astounding to me and to so many others. Let's move on to another victory. Any one of you jump in. There's a residual from House Bill 6 that was passed by the Ohio legislature for its $61 million bribe that subsidizes two coal burners, one of which is in Indiana, for God's sakes. Have any of you heard anything about the possibility that the House Ohio legislature would independently repeal that bailout? Has anybody talked about that? Any of you guys heard anything on that? No. Okay. So
I don't know. It's really ironic that the coal bailout stands because you've got a very active Sierra Club Beyond Coal campaign in Ohio. We were very appreciative of them helping fight the nuclear bailout, but it was largely because it was tied to the coal bailout. It was a package deal. And I did want to mention that these coal burners are ancient. They are 1950s era coal burners associated with the enrichment of uranium at Portsmouth, Ohio and Paducah, Kentucky. So one of our, you know, stalwarts in anti-nuclear lawyering, Terry Lodge, grew up in Madison, Indiana, suffered asthma as a young person because he lived immediately downwind of one of these coal burners that they're keeping going. I mean, these are filthy, dirty 1950s coal burners that used to, some of them, be exclusively electrifying the gaseous diffusion uranium enrichment.
Well, it's beyond me how there hasn't been a bill introduced to repeal the subsidy on just those two coal burners. I can't imagine that's not going to happen, but so far, it seems like it hasn't.
And one of the beneficiaries of the coal bailout is American Electric Power, which is based in Ohio, which happens to own the Cook Nuclear Power Plant in southwest Michigan, two giant reactors on the Lake Michigan shore. So they don't really need the bailout. They're filthy rich to begin with.
Yeah, and they also own American Electric Power, ironically, is one of the biggest wind-owning utilities in the country. They own a ton of the windmills in Texas. I assume some of their windmills froze during the recent cold spell there. And I want to point out real quickly, because we tend to go fast and lose these points, a lot of the right-wingers, Tucker Carlson and all those idiots, were talking about how the blackout and the energy shortages in Texas during the cold spell were allegedly due to the freezing up of the wind generators. Not one of them ever mentioned that the intake pumps at the South Texas nuclear plant froze. And, you know, God help us if there had been a follow-up accident because of the freezing of the intake system at South Texas on Unit 1 anyway. And, of course, all the gas and oil facilities froze, too. But all these right-wingers jumped in and blamed the windmills. And it certainly is the fault of the company whoever installed those windmills in South Texas should have installed windmills that could have withstood, and there's certainly plenty of them, the cold that did come down there. I mean, the cold in Texas was not sufficient to freeze windmills that are operating in Wisconsin, Michigan, and other cold climates, but of course they all jumped in on that. So one other pet gripe, they're all screaming about the censorship, the cancel culture on Dr. Seuss, but not one of them has ever talked about the Lorax. All these guys, starting with Rush Limbaugh, who screamed about tree huggers, they would have canceled Dr. Seuss a long time ago because of his environmental book, which is actually one of the great books ever written. There you go. There, talk about slipping in your 2 cents worth. So listen, Tim Judson, you're in New York, and you've got a bailout situation very similar to what happened in Ohio with HB 6, and we now just extracted the nuclear bailout from Ohio. We also seem to be on the brink, I hope, of extracting Andrew Cuomo from the governor's office in New York. What is, if anything, is happening with the bailout of the 4 reactors in New York? And then we'll go to Kevin and Paul.
Well, the bailout of the nuclear of the 4 reactors in New York just sort of chugs along. I mean, it's a 12-year bailout program that started in 2017 and it's going to end in 2029. And the cost of it goes up every 2 years. So, you know, New Yorkers have shelled out over $2 billion in subsidies to these 4 nukes so far, and the cost just went up another $40 or $50 million a year. And there's still $5.5 billion to go. You know, the interesting thing that's happening is that, since the bailout was put in place, you know, the state has passed, you know, much stronger renewable energy and energy efficiency laws. That are getting, that have the state on track to be, you know, to have 70% renewables by 2030, you know, millions of megawatt hours a year of reduced demand from energy efficiency. The whole rationale for the bailout has since evaporated, and yet the ratepayers are locked into this 12-year program. But because of this new law that's in place, the state is now starting to do some real energy planning with public input. And so it's really going to be front and center on the table that they've got a plan for the phase out of these reactors by the time these subsidies expire.
Wow. And I do want to mention, of course, cause for celebration. And Tim and Paul and Kevin, you've all been involved with this. But Tim being in New York is this month, we will see the shutdown of Indian Point Reactor number 3, which means that site will now be dead, dead, dead. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, this is an historic fight. It's been going on for, you know, since the 70s, people wanting to close these two dirty and dangerous reactors just 25 miles north of New York City, you know, within, you know, 50 miles of 20 million people. But Indian Point 2, under this agreement between Entergy, the company that owns it, and the state and the environmental organization Riverkeeper, shut down Indian Point 2 in 2020, and by the end of April, Indian Point 3 is going to be shut down as well. It's really an historic victory. It's going to be a sea change.
Well, we're going to have a celebration. Unfortunately, we have to be by Zoom, but that is a really big deal. And I guess we can thank Andrew Cuomo for that. I mean, I assume, given the nature of our corrupt nuclear apparatus, that if they had wanted without the governor's intervention to keep Indian Point going, I guess they could have, right?
Well, you know, absolutely. I mean, two of the major things that Andrew Cuomo has done as governor that aren't corrupt are shutting Indian Point and banning fracking. It's just that, you know, he's inconsistent.
Yeah, that's to put it mildly. Kevin Camps, you want to jump in on this, and then Paul?
Well, just briefly, the point about Cuomo's good work at Indian Point, his line was, what are New Yorkers supposed to do, swim to Jersey if something goes wrong? You know, you can't evacuate
right.
20 million people in a hurry, that's for sure. There's no evacuation routes to use. The point is, up on the Lake Ontario shoreline in upstate, what are New Yorkers supposed to do, swim to Ontario? I mean, these are, I think, that 9 Mile Point Unit 1 is the oldest operating reactor in the country, now that reactors
yes,
like Oyster Creek have shut
That's
down.
Right.
And the fight has moved now to, you know, the state of New York Attorney General, Letitia James, challenging the corrupt criminal corporation called Holtec from taking over the Indian Point site, where they would try to loot the $2 billion decommissioning trust fund to the tune of $600 million just for irradiated nuclear fuel management, which is non-decommissioning related. But NRC is a rubber stamp. They grant the waivers and exemptions whenever asked. So the fight is on in federal court now on that question.
Well, it is truly astounding. But a 9 mile point did open in 69. You have to think about a 9 mile point. This plant is pre-digital. I mean, as are many of the reactors. I guess with Indian Point shutting, we'll be down to 93, I believe. And many of them were designed on slide rules. I mean, these and if a plant opens in 69, it was designed in the 50s, for God's sakes. And you can see these guys with their white shirts and their, you know, their nerdy whatever is walking out with their slide rules, designing a reactor that's now operating 70 years later or whatever it is. I mean, so Paul Gunter, what do you want to say about Indian Point and the other reactors in New York?
Well, of course, 9 Mile Point 1 and Fitzpatrick are both General Electric Mark 1 boiling water reactors. These are, you know, identical to Fukushima Daiichi, and the demonstrated 100% failure rate for GE reactors under full power that experience station blackout. So, you know, the concerns from the Fukushima accident, we haven't really seen the you know, 9 mile point one should have been shut down right then. But they have also been keeping it online without, you know, some of the measures that made a lot of sense. You know, there was at one point, there was a unanimous decision among the NRC management that if you were going to continue to operate 9 mile point one without an operable containment system, like was demonstrated at Fukushima, that it would require of filtration systems for venting containment so that you could vent hydrogen gas and pressure and heat, but you would actually still contain the radioactivity. And there was a unanimous decision to make the industry afford that cost, but, you know, eventually the commission just overruled that. So, you know, even in the industry's best interest, these plants are now, they continue to operate, and, you know, on a wish and a prayer that you don't have the circumstances of a station blackout there.
Yeah, I mean, it's astounding. These people are so short-sighted. And I want to talk real quick. We go do another round on the Biden appointment to the NRC. I mean, he looks like a Trump guy. I would have hoped that the new administration would have seen a problem at the NRC. And, you know, Biden lived in Delaware right across the river from, is it Salem or Hope Creek, one of the reactor facilities. And he made some pretty negative comments about nuclear power back in the day. But suddenly he comes in and nuclear is in the so-called clean energy package. And he's also put why don't you, Tim Judson, and then Kevin and Paul, tell us about this new guy he's put on the NRC.
Are you referring to Commissioner Hansen, the new chair?
Yeah, I mean, what's the deal with him? Why, Biden, he seems like a
hack.
Well,
I mean, this is clear. This is clearly, you know, something that the Biden administration is trying to thread the needle politically with. I mean, you know, Commissioner Hansen was initially appointed by Trump last year, you know, when they have to pair sort of Democratic and Republican appointments when they have multiple seats to fill. But Biden should have picked Commissioner Barron, who's been a really, you know, sort of vocal commissioner for nuclear safety. But seemed to have picked Glick mostly because that was the industry's preference.
Well, does he get another appointment? And what is the makeup of the commission right now?
Well, there's actually one vacancy and one upcoming vacancy. So the previous chairperson, Svinicki, who was a Republican, retired in January after Biden's election was confirmed. And that's when Biden appointed the new chair. But her seat is now vacant and it needs to be filled. And then also Commissioner Annie Caputo, her term expires in June. And so Biden's going to, he's got two seats to fill coming up in the next few months.
And Barron will stay on the commission. Is that right?
Yeah, his term extends for another couple of years.
So theoretically, Biden could make two safety-oriented appointments, and we would have a safety-oriented majority on the commission. Is that possible, Kevin?
Yeah, technically. I mean, like Tim said, there's often this dance. So Biden being a Democrat in the White House, the way it's worked traditionally at the NRC is that the majority of the commission is going to be Democrat. So that's three members, and two members will be Republican, and that's how the two parties have worked it out over the decades. The problem is that some of the Democrats that have served on the commission, like McGaffigan, like Magwood in the past, have been some of the most pro-nuclear commissioners ever. And here we have Hansen, and I just wanted to fill in a little bit about his background. Turns out he's from South Haven, Michigan, which is the Palisades company town. And sure enough, he sings the praises of Palisades that, you know, they've never done anything wrong. They're perfect. And he also comes out of the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy, which is explicitly promotional. He's not the first commissioner to do that. Lyons would be an example of that. Magwood as well. It's a problem, though, because it very much blurs the line of this separation of nuclear power's promotion at the DOE. That's their mandate. And NRC's supposed mandate, which is safety, environment, security, and health protection. But here we have a promoter chairing the NRC. And the final thing I wanted to say about Hansen is that he was a senior staffer for Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senator from California, Democrat, worked for her on the powerful Energy and Water Appropriations Subcommittee, where the two of them working together with the rest of the staff promoted consolidated interim storage facilities as best they could for a decade. And we were able to head them off on the worst of it. But even on the commission, before he became chairman, he was simply another one of the commissioners for a short time. And sure enough, he voted against us, as did Barron, unfortunately, and the rest of the commissioners on consolidated interim storage. They rejected every one of more than 100 contentions that a coalition of groups brought. And so on this consolidated interim storage facility question, the NRC has really been horrible. But we are taking that fight into federal court as we speak as well.
Well, is Hansen technically considered a Democrat?
Yes, he is. He is a Democrat.
Not good then, is it? So, Paul Gunter, if we have two vacancies, and one guy, Barron, who is considered reasonable on safety, which is such a rare, it's like a dodo in nature on the commission, is there any chance that we're going to get a three-person majority on the commission that might be interested in safety?
I think that would be asking the leopard to change its spots. The the NRC is 90% of its budget comes from licensing fees from the nuclear power industry. So there's that built-in bias. I would note that Chairman Hansen is also, he's got a degree in theology. So, I guess we could take some comfort that, there's going to be a bit more than just the luck of the draw with these nuclear power stations, as they continue to grow older. But aging in this industry equates to increasing danger. And so we're going to have some solace that maybe Hansen will be putting in a prayer for us as we continue forward.
Well, I suggest that they install a glass case in every operating room with a Bible in it, so that if they start to have a meltdown, they can break the case and open up the Bible and pray for all of us. My contention now is that, and I was just on an interview by John Stossel, of all people, and I assumed that he was going to follow my interview with the guy, Shishkoff, from the Institute there in California. But my contention is, in terms of big reactors, there's no longer an issue. I mean, you've got Volvo in Georgia coming in, if they're lucky, and if they actually open the thing, at $30 billion. You just had VC Summer, the two reactors there, cease construction after having blown $10 billion. So I think, to quote Dizzy Dean, the chances of any new large reactor projects starting in the United States are slim to none. But then when people ask me to talk about nuclear power, I say there's no longer a unified nuclear power issue. There's 93 separate issues. And the only issues that matter are the status of each individual operating reactor in the country. I mean, if somebody's going to tell me they're in favor of nuclear power because of this, this, and this, I'm going to say, okay, let's go through the 93 reactors after Indian Point shuts, and you tell me exactly how safe they are. So then the question, you can, and Tim, Kevin, and Paul, you can comment on that. But then the question is, of course, the small reactors. And we've got Bill Gates, who seems to be on the wrong side of history on everything he touches, arguing for small reactors. So, Tim, can you comment, especially with the four in New York State, on the status of the 93 big ones, and then what's happening with the small ones?
Sure, Harvey. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the question is, given the urgency of the climate crisis, how are we going to get to zero emissions? And, these reactors in the U.S., we have the oldest fleet nuclear power plants in the world, are all aging and becoming increasingly uneconomical. Some are more uneconomical than others, and those reactors have been the first ones to shut down. But the question is, how are we going to manage this energy transition? How are we going to get to 100% renewables? And the question that you've always got to ask is, look, how dangerous are these things? How much? What's the actual environmental risk that's involved in this? And then, how quickly can we build up renewables to replace them? You know, what's happening this year or what happened last year in Iowa should be a case study, because, the Duane Arnold reactor shut down in August after being hit by a derecho, a windstorm. But Iowa built enough new wind power last year to make up for more than the electricity that Duane Arnold ever generated. And so they're going to still see a net reduction in emissions, even with closing their nuclear power plant. And that's really what we should be doing around the country.
Absolutely. Kevin Camps?
Yeah, I was just going to mention, I read your piece, Harvey, that you wrote with Carl Grossman about not only Christopher Hansen, but Biden's other appointees to various posts. And one of the people you covered was Gina McCarthy, who was Obama's second and last EPA administrator. And I happened to attend a Grist interview with her a couple weeks back, and that was the first shoe to drop in my world on this nuclear power question in the Biden infrastructure package, because Gina McCarthy, it was mentioned in passing, but it was quite clear that she was all for nuclear power subsidies in the infrastructure package, both for old reactors already existing and proposed new ones. And on the small modular reactor question, what I wanted to point out is, small doesn't mean beautiful. Small doesn't mean safe. Just look at Fermi Unit 1, which was 60-odd megawatts electric. It had a meltdown in 1966, and we almost lost Detroit. Look at Big Rock Point in Michigan, which was 67 megawatts electric. It didn't have a meltdown, but it did have fuel damage in its core and released god-awful amounts of radioactive iodine 131, and probably other isotopes in those releases. I once compiled the admitted releases that were on the documents at the NRC docket for Big Rock Point, and it was over 3 million curies that they admitted to, which is nightmarish. And sure enough, there's anecdotal evidence of thyroid pathology near Big Rock Point. Some of the watchdogs up there themselves have suffered thyroid problems over the decades. Dr. Gerald Drake and his wife, Martha Drake, she's a statistician. They've both passed on since, but they did a statistical analysis of spina bifida in the Big Rock Point area and found that it was statistically significant increases in the local population in children. So small reactors are not safe inherently at all. We just had a release in the Washington, D.C. metro region in early February from the National Institutes of Standards and Testing research reactor, which is 20 megawatts, the largest research reactor in the country. And sure enough, they had fuel damage and released radioactivity to the environment, although it's been kept very quiet thus far.
Unreal. Of course, you know, when we say we almost lost Detroit because of the Fermi accident in 66, for me, it's we almost lost Ann Arbor because I was at the University of Michigan on the very day that that happened. Paul Gunter, you another Michigan boy, you want to jump in?
Well, you know, I think these small modular reactors are, at this point, they're still very much mirage. The real SMRs that we should be supporting are small modular renewables. These are the original modular units when you're talking about solar panels and wind turbines. And collectively, this is the 21st century energy policy. The bridge to the future for nuclear power right now is really the whole idea of extreme license extensions. You know, of the... You know, we've got 94 operating now, 87 units, some have been closed, but 87 units are now in either approved for a 40 to 60 license extension or operating in that extension period. Four just got approved to go from 60 to 80 years. And now the NRC is talking about extending operating licenses 80 to 100 years. So the real, the material structure of this industry is literally crumbling at the concrete at Seabrook. The large irreplaceable components like the, 90-foot pressure vessel is irreplaceable for however long you intend to run these things. And we don't really understand the all the knowledge gaps about how cracks initiate or how quick a crack can grow to failure like we're seeing. These are the concerns that the industry is driving nuclear regulatory capture right now. That's what the NRC has to be recognized right now.
God, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. Kevin, I know you have to go at some point. Do you want to come in with another statement? And you can just sign off when you need to.
Just a follow-up on Paul just now, we are fighting the Point Beach Units 1 and 2 80-year operating license. We've teamed up with Physicians for Social Responsibility Wisconsin, who are the official intervener, but we're just helping them as best we can. And the top issue at Point Beach is that Unit 2
is tied with Palisades on either side of Lake Michigan for being the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country.
Hey,
so the good news. The good news at Palisades is that they plan to shut down supposedly by the end of May 2022. So we have about a year of very high risk operations to go at Palisades. But at Point Beach, the problem is they're planning to operate for another 30 years. And NRC is not doing a thing about the embrittlement issue. So that's why we're fighting it so hard. And we're joined by Arne Gunderson as our expert witness on embrittlement. And we're also joined to make a point that both Tim and Paul made about the promise of renewables. We're joined by two experts. One is Mark Cooper of Vermont Law School, and the other is Dr. Al Campan of University of Toledo Physics Department. And they really laid out the alternative of renewables at Point Beach. Incredibly, the company, in its environmental impact statement, only looked at solar backed up by natural gas as one alternative, and they also looked at the alternative of building 21 small modular reactors to replace Point Beach. So yeah, we decided to add to the alternatives, and Dr. Campan looked at an all-solar alternative, and it's always very inspiring to read his work. And Dr. Cooper did the calculations, and one of the amazing things that he had to say in his expert testimony was just from now until the early 2030s, that's even before this, you know, extra license extension would kick in, that Wisconsin ratepayers are going to pay $5 billion more to get their electricity from this dangerously old atomic reactor complex than they would if it was simply replaced with renewable alternatives as quickly as possible. $5 billion surcharge.
Well, we're looking at a similar situation. By the way, you just heard some noise in the background. I'm actually sitting doing this interview at my old hippie farm in Massachusetts, where we pioneered the No Nukes movement. And it's still going since 1968. There's actually a movie out there. Any of you who are interested, it's called Under the Ground. It's a documentary film about the old Liberation News Service. We had a radical news service in the 1960s. We were infiltrated by the FBI and split up, but the FBI never counted on us coming to a farm in Massachusetts where I am now, and which is incredibly beautiful shape. And there you go. So I'm at the home of doing this radio show at the home of the original. Right here is where we printed the first No Nukes bumper stickers in 1974 when we were so grateful for Northeast Utilities to come in and try and build two nuclear plants before we shut. And then we started commuting to see Paul Gunter up at Seabrook, and the rest, as they say, is history. So, you know, we're facing a similar situation in California, the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors. A deal has been struck to shut them in 24 and 25, although people are sniping at the edges of that one. Those two reactors, certainly Unit 1, is extremely embrittled, surrounded by earthquake faults, 45 miles from the San Andreas, for God's sakes, and we have been unable even to get the state to force an inspection. They won't even inspect these two reactors. I mean, it's outrageous. So, well, let's hope that the Biden administration's simultaneous push for renewables, and there's no doubt they seem committed to renewables, but this simultaneous push with nuclear, I don't know, man. The persistence of this industry is just astonishing to me. I mean, Tim, in New York, Tim Judson from Nuclear Information Resource Service, in New York, do you see any chance of circumventing this bailout and cutting short the life of these four reactors?
I mean, it's extraordinarily unpopular, and no one in the New York State government even wants to talk about it at this point. And so, you know, the question is, is Exelon going to be able to pull enough, you know, political strings to get the state, you know, to renew it somehow? You know, there's really, like I mentioned before, there's really no rationale for it. I mean, even at the, you know, even when it was passed in 2016, the reason that the state gave for it was that they really weren't very far along in building renewables in New York. And so they didn't see a way to replace those reactors with, you know, without natural gas. But here we are a few years later, they've got a 70% renewable energy standard, massive energy efficiency targets. When they passed at the time, there was actually a study presented to the state that showed that if they had enacted an energy efficiency standard at the time, it would have reduced electricity demand by the same amount of electricity as those four reactors generate, but at a cost savings to ratepayers of $3 billion. And so the difference between bailing out these nukes for $7.5 billion versus having saved $3 billion from energy efficiency would have been $10 billion more the state would have had on hand to invest in renewables and electrification, you know, electric vehicles, battery storage, heat pumps, than it's going to have. And so the idea that, you know, that they would continue this bailout past 2029 it's already proved to be a bad investment. It's really going to be, you know, and this is the same going on across the country, whether it's Ohio or Illinois or the federal government, is that our energy policy is driven by corporate interests and it circumvents reason. And so the question is really whether we're going to continue letting corporations dictate our energy policy. And if we do that, we're never going to solve the climate crisis anyway. But if we can break that cycle, then replacing nuclear power and fossil fuels with renewables and all these other clean energy technologies, it was going to be a no-brainer.
Well, it's insane. I mean, in California, the Diablo Canyon nuclear plants, which are being kept open, you know, for no real reason, are losing. The power they generate at Diablo Canyon is $3.5 million a day above market rate. And to keep the two reactors operating at Diablo through 24 and 5, surrounded by earthquake faults, embrittled beyond belief, is going to cost California ratepayers $3, $4, $5 billion, something like that, maybe more. And these are PG&E's own numbers. Paul Gunter, you want to jump in on that?
Well, I think that the big mistake that Biden's making with this national climate, effort is that he's looking to share nuclear's insatiable appetite for cost, and at this juncture we should be working full speed ahead with what the market will support. But instead, it looks like Biden's going to throw the nuclear anchor out as well, and that will, it will divert resources from effective climate change, effective climate action, and this is going to be the struggle with the Biden administration, is this this inability to recognize that nuclear power is the most expensive way to boil water ever conceived, and that's whether it's a huge reactor or a pocket reactor. The smaller they get, the cost per kilowatt hour goes up. So, this is going to be our struggle for the next 4 years.
Well, one of the interesting arguments that they make, and I want to throw this in, is you mentioned a windstorm shut Duane Arnold in Iowa, and I assume it's down forever, right? It's not going to reopen.
Yeah, it's decommissioning.
What's that?
It is decommissioning.
Well, good. So, you know, lightning, a stroke of lightning shut Yankee Row. I always love that story. And then the ice shut down South Texas nuclear plant. Earthquake shut down reactors in Virginia and Ohio. So the idea that these are black boxes that are immune from natural phenomenon are ridiculous. And, of course, Cooper in Nebraska was flooded. Why they reopened that thing is beyond me, but I assume it's reopened. Is that right?
Yes.
So
another General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor.
Well, right. But actually, so, it's actually instructive, though, because, you know, Cooper, you know, which is in Nebraska and the site got flooded, you know, has continued operating. But back in 2011, right after Fukushima, it was the Fort Calhoun nuclear reactor in Nebraska that was flooded and shut down for months. And they brought that
reactor
back
online. But they
reopened
that one too, right?
They brought it back online, but after about 3 or 4 years, the utility realized how completely expensive and uneconomical it was, and that it was going to be cheaper for them to shut it down and replace it with renewables and efficiency. And that's what they ended up doing in 2015.
Well, the great irony of the no nukes movement is that we have been, and again, I'm speaking to you from the site where the first no nukes bumper stickers were printed. I actually have from this Montague Farm the first T-shirt. It's really got a lot of holes in it, but the first no nukes T-shirt is in an archive at the University of Massachusetts, 11 miles from here. So the irony is that the no nukes movement is actually a market-driven phenomenon. We helped birth there was a Toward Tomorrow Fair at UMass in 75 where Amory Lovins and William Hieronymus gave an overview of a solartopian future, and we really have the market on our side. Whenever I argue against nukes, I just say abolish all subsidies. Stop subsidizing solar as long as you stop subsidizing coal, oil, nukes, and gas. We are just about out of time. Tim Judson from NIRS, it's great to have you with us. You want to give us 60 seconds, and then Paul. I think Kevin is gone. Thank you, Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, for being with us. Tim Judson, give us 60 seconds from New York, and Paul from D.C. Tim?
Yeah, sure, Harvey. Thanks. I mean, you know, what I would say, you know, this is going back to the conversation about the Biden administration, is, you know, that I think that everyone is daunted by the task of what it's going to take to solve the climate crisis. And, you know, given, you know, sort of, you know, what's happened in this country over the last several decades, it's understandable. But the reality is that the solutions are here. But what's also true is that, you know, on the one hand, Congress is partly responsible for the NRC being asleep at the wheel in terms of nuclear safety, because Congress members have been demanding that NRC cut back its regulations for many years now. But at the same time, you know, the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis issued its climate policy recommendations last summer. And, you know, and they with a huge priority on environmental and climate justice, which is, you know, really a sea change in Congress to hear Congress members endorsing racial equity and justice in our energy policy. While they still supported nuclear as part of climate, you know, in that report, they also said that there are major environmental justice problems with the nuclear industry. And not only that, but if nuclear is going to continue to be part of our energy mix, then it's got to be regulated more strongly. And I think that's really something that Congress needs to be forced to make good on.
Okay, Tim Judson of NIRS, NIRS.org. Always an honor to have you on, and see if you can get Cuomo out of there, and maybe with T-shirt, somebody else will stop that subsidy in its tracks. Thank you. Paul Gunter from BeyondNuclear.org.
Thank you, Harvey. I think that just one closing quick note I'll make is that the U.S. Supreme Court just rejected 200 sailors on the USS Reagan who were, you know, in the South China Sea, or I should say the Pacific, just off the coast of Fukushima during the 2011 accident, who've put in claims for radiation sickness and the chronic illnesses that they experienced afterward. The Supreme Court just rejected their appeal to have those hearings litigated in the United States, and basically says that they've got to go to Japan to get their health cases
litigated. Terrible. That's terrible. Paul Gunter, you're always great, beyondnuclear.org. Thank you, Tim, Paul, Kevin Camps. We'll be back next week with our regular broadcast of the Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom calls. And all I can say is, you know, no nukes, folks,
We will see you in Solartopia. Let's shut down these reactors before the next one blows up, for God's sakes, and convert 100% to renewable. Thank you, crew in New York, and we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve?